Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? 9 minutes after 9 o'clock here on the West Coast, but 9 minutes after the top of the hour. Here on All Marine Radio. Joining me is Alex Hollings on a Monday. Alex, how you doing? What's going on?
Not too bad. I'm doing pretty well. I somehow managed to wake up with like an infected eyelash follicle. So I look like I got into a fight last night. I look like I have a black eye. But other than that, I'm good.
Infected? Did I hear that right? Eyelash follicle? Are you not? Are you struggling removing your eyeliner? What is going on?
Well, you know, I've been trying to, you know, glam up my look.
There are a lot of video conferencing going on. I feel you.
Yeah, I'm trying to make sure that, you know, I'm putting my best foot forward on those. But I don't know. My right eye is just my lower eyelid is swollen like I got punched in the face last night. So maybe my wife is beating me in my sleep. That seems possible too.
You know, there you go. So I saw a post that you put up about your mother. How's your mom?
She's actually, I have great news, which is awesome. But so my mom was tested. She's been tested a total of 3 times now for the coronavirus. The first time was last month when one of her patients tested positive. So at the facility, my mom's an infection control nurse. So at the facility she worked at, they tested the nurses.
At a hospital or where?
In a nursing home here in Georgia. Actually, in a fairly rural nursing home here in Georgia, which is part of the challenge. You know, from what I understand, there is a great deal. There's been an influx of things like masks and PPE. But you know, any system takes a while, right? So the places that kind of garner the most attention are the cities, so they're getting the most early focus, and the support in terms of PPE and stuff hasn't quite trickled down as effectively to rural facilities as it has to urban ones. So they've been really limited on things like masks and gloves and stuff. So my mom got tested last month and came back negative, which was great. But it took 2 weeks, you know, for that test to come back, which I found to be very troubling, especially because not only is she an infection control nurse, but she's a lady in her 60s who's got a number of medical issues that kind of make her high risk. So I tried to talk her into retiring. She was supposed to retire a year ago, said that she'd rather keep working. She just bought a house. So obviously that plays a big role in it. But so, you know, we had a scare last month and it turned out okay. She was fine. But then early last week, she had a fever and was starting to exhibit symptoms of COVID-19 infections. So she was put into quarantine and tested. And again, testing is not super fast here in rural Georgia. So she got a test on Tuesday and was told to expect results by early this week. But then she waited a few days and she was getting worse. So they pushed her in for one of the rapids tests, which I guess a lot of emergency rooms can do. So she had that done over the weekend. The test came back negative over the weekend. My mom is just the good old fashioned version of sick and miserable instead of the new and exciting version of sick and miserable. So it seems weird to celebrate my mom just having a bad case of the flu. But with all things being considered, with my mom's underlying medical conditions and stuff, she's in a much better place to kind of fight her way back from what is still a serious illness, but maybe isn't as big a risk to her as the coronavirus may have been because of her underlying health problems. So even though my mom is still super sick, we are all celebrating the fact that it's a super sick kind of, you know, she's just got like a real bad bug. You know, and she should bounce back from it in plenty of time. She's been sent home so that way she will hopefully not contract the COVID-19 while recovering, because her immune system's obviously in pretty rough shape right now. But all things considered, it's a big victory for us. I'm really stoked.
Well, that's good. I mean, I think one of the things that all of this has pointed out, and I was reading a couple articles. Tom Friedman wrote a piece about about Sweden's approach to it. And he actually kind of got it wrong in the piece, because Sweden says, look, we're not, our goal is not herd immunity. Our goal is to enact public policies that are sustainable. And we don't believe that, you know, we don't believe that a lot of policies we see around the world are sustainable. In fact, we know they're not. And so he said, but one of the things where we see, where we know that we failed, and this has been a problem in Sweden for a while, is the quality of care in our nursing home and our senior living facilities. That's a huge problem. They are the most vulnerable, and we have not done that very well, and we intend to change that. So,
and honestly, I think that that's an issue we have here. Both my parents worked in nursing homes. My dad was an administrator. He ran a veterans home for some time. My mom's been in – she was an LPN when I was born. She's been an RN for most of my life in nursing homes specifically. And even though I would – I feel that inclination to kind of defend what my parents have done for a living, I've seen them struggle with the challenges of – companies that don't want to really invest in patient care.
Well, I mean, it's it's a question of resources, not of intentions, right? You know, so you know what you need to do, but you don't have the resources to do it. You're doing it on Medicaid money sometimes. You're doing it on Medicare money, and those are all capped. And so you know, who wants to do that kind of work of cleaning up after senior citizens, bathing them, caring for them when they –
especially those that are in a tough spot, those that have mental issues that make them difficult to be around sometimes. Right.
And then to clean up after them physically on a daily basis and to take care of their needs on a daily basis. I mean, you can't pay people looking at the budgets, you can't pay them, to get the kind of people that you really want, and the work's difficult. And so, it all kind of cascades down from there. But they are the most vulnerable. And when you look at all of this, somebody walks in and spreads that into a long-term care facility and into a senior living facility, right? And the employees can deal with it because their immune systems are better. But the older people there, it just wrecks them.
And those employees end up a lot of times unintentionally becoming carriers, because a Absolutely. Family member will come to visit, grandma, which with the best of intentions, they're asymptomatic, so they don't realize that they're carrying it. They give it to grandma, who may get really lucky even and be asymptomatic. Although a lot of people, as you were saying, in old folks' homes, they're kind of the highest risk demographic we've got, right?
Right.
But, grandma can unintentionally, without even knowing she was ever exposed, give it to the CNA who comes in and serves her lunch, and to the LPN that's on MedPass, and to the RNs that are checking on her every day, and to the MDs, especially when it comes to that doctor level and some of those senior nurses, where a lot of them will have a patient caseload where there's, maybe two dozen patients that they're going to see a day. So the opportunity to infect the whole facility is just really high in a lot of these nursing homes, especially, like you're saying, the ones that don't have the resources to be fully staffed, the ones that live in lower income areas, the ones that tend to get – I'll cite myself here. When my father had a stroke and we weren't able to take care of him at home anymore – he ended up in an assisted living facility, and we did our best to afford it, but it was literally thousands of dollars a month.
Oh, yeah.
So we ended up having to make my father a ward of the state in order to be able to afford the level of care he needed, because it was a really severe stroke, so we didn't have a lot of function left. So a lot of these folks are the state is effectively paying for their care the lowest possible amount that the state can. Because, again, the state is also trying to stretch its resources.
Alex, you know, what you did with your mom, but what you have to do, there's a whole process for – you have to sell everything that he owns and get to a certain threshold to qualify for Medicaid, and then essentially becomes a ward of the state. But that's how you financially protect other – the spouse.
And honestly, even that isn't inexpensive. We had to hire an attorney
right.
So that we could negotiate the agreement so that we'd still have some say in his care, even though we weren't footing the bill. And so it was an expensive transition, but the expensive transition was cheaper than the $6,000 a month that my brothers and I were trying to kind of pool together. You know, it costs a lot of money to take care of people who are in a rough shape like that. So I'm certainly not faulting nursing homes, but it's a ticking time bomb when it comes to infections like this.
But when we look at the problem, somehow or other, you know, and again, this goes back to Medicare rates, Medicaid rates. What's going to happen with those are going to go up, which means somebody's got to pay for that shit.
Absolutely.
And it's going to be, you know, it's somebody's going to get taxed to pay for that. And so that's
the thing that I think a lot of people don't realize, especially when it comes to like these times, which are obviously difficult for everyone. But when the government gives money to people, that money has to come from somewhere. And if it doesn't today, it means we're taking it from tomorrow. That's just how it works. You know, like a lot of people want the government to do more for them in general. It's a really strong sentiment, I would say, particularly among younger Americans. But you should try to maintain a state of mind where you go, I should get as much out of my relationship with the government as I'm putting into it. Because if the government is spending more money on me per year than I am putting into it through paying taxes, that means that we're running at a loss, right? And that's not sustainable. So when people say the government should pay for college or the government should pay for healthcare, for some people that may well be the case. But we all have to be cognizant of the fact that money comes from something, you know? Yeah.
That's my
worry about the modern economy right now, right, with all the COVID-19 stimulus stuff going on.
And that's what, to me, is significant about the Swedish response is when you hear them talk about it, it's like, we're trying to do something sustainable here because, again, here in the United States, we've hit the pause button on it. Well, what happens when you hit play? All those numbers are going to go up. They have to as more and more people go out and get it, and it'll wash.
Well, honestly, we're seeing that in Georgia. You're totally right.
Right. You know, and so, but that shouldn't be alarming because the cases will go up. What we really got to focus on is the number of people that go into the ICU and the number of people that die, because that means either they did things they shouldn't have done because they had high comorbidity rates or factors. And so to me, that's it, that it will wash through. For instance, I think I saw an article about they randomly tested, I want to say, almost 1,000 people in Afghanistan, somewhere between 800 and 1,000 people, and they found out that 30% of the people in test, you know, had been exposed to it. And so that gives you something. So you're seeing every study, and again, after you discount for false positives, and it's not, well, truly representative of the whole population because it wasn't, the population wasn't reflected in the statistical sample. Okay, I got that. But when study after study after study after study after study after study after study comes back and says, look, it's somewhere between 20 and 30% of the population right now that's been exposed to it, which is far more, you know, there's a lot of implications for that as we come out of it. I mean, what? And if the numbers tick up in Georgia, are they going to shut the state back down?
I think that there's one more number that we should add to that list that we should keep tabs on, and that's rate of infection among those tested, right? And because that's kind of a way – all the data everyone's working with right now are effectively extrapolations, right? We're just trying to get more and more specific about what we're extrapolating. But I think that that's part of the problem with the national solution. This is something I credit Trump with throughout a lot of this, is that he's been saying the governors should be making most of these decisions. And I know in some states there's been a lot of backlash towards those governors. But I do not think, you know, I can compare this to the Second Amendment argument, right? I don't think that laws that make sense in New York City make sense in rural Montana. And I don't think that a opening up strategy that makes sense in rural Montana makes sense in New York City, right?
Oh, dude, let me just tell you, I mean, and California is a case in point. We have a governor who's trying to apply the same, you know, solution to, you know,
to a massive state,
to rural Northern California counties that don't have any cases. And they're like, sorry, we're just going to open. And then even the whole thing last weekend in down here in Southern California, if you talk to the law enforcement people, they said 90% of people that were at the beaches were social distancing and they had no issue with. There's 10% of people doing stupid stuff. But that one picture that went all over the country was from a telephoto lens shot on the horizontal and was not emblematic of the weekend. And yet the governor reacts to that. And so, you know, it's just like, come on now. We need to be grown-ups. And you know, different states are going to come out with different solution. And the requirement is not going to be perfect, but you have to evolve it where you protect the most vulnerable. And you come out of this and you rely on the American people. Because I don't know about you, Alex. I'd be curious. But where I go, you know, like I was yesterday, I was at Home Depot. I went to Big Five Sporting Goods on Saturday. Colleen and I went to McDonald's. We drove up to see the protesters in Huntington Beach. So everywhere I go, you see people with masks on. You see people spread out. So it's not like people don't get it. Is it the same way in Georgia, or do you see a fair amount of people that
– I'd say that the majority of people are pretty responsible. But to your 10% point, I would argue that there are kind of two groups in Georgia. There are the people who seem like they're either taking this seriously or they're at least respecting that others are. You know what I mean? Like they're being respectful and not climbing all over you. But there's definitely, you know, Georgia has got a real rebellious spirit. You know what I mean? You see a lot of Confederate flags in Georgia still, which I understand to a lot of places in the country, they find that very offensive. And in a lot of my experiences, I'm not a fan of the Confederate flag because you guys were traitors from my flag. But in my experience, a lot of these guys have Confederate flags because they know it'll piss somebody off from New York. More so than any real ideology, but
now let me make a comment about that. That is my experience. I kind of liken it a little bit to like the scout sniper thing and pissing on bodies. If you ask those young Marines who did that shit, do you know that that's a symbol of the SS in World War II? They'll look at you and like, what?
Yeah, no, I didn't know that.
No, it's like the band Kiss, man. It's the SS, and it's like cool. Like you're like, there's other things associated with
looking badass.
To me, the Confederate flag is more about I'm Southern, fuck you, right?
That is to a T. I agree completely. And I mean, I know a lot of guys down here that are the stereotypical Southerner, Southern Georgian, who you'd expect to be racist and aren't, you know. But that's neither here nor there. But what I mean about that rebel spirit, though, is that there is a big, you can't tell me what to do. So if you tell me what to do, I'm going to go as far to the opposite extreme as I can to show you how hard I won't do it. Right. And in Georgia, that's mostly manifested in families that go shopping as a group and make kind of a big spectacle out of not respecting other people's space. And I would say that they're not the majority at all. They are the minority, but they're certainly present. You know, so I think that most people are pretty responsible. I think that there are that 10% who are convinced that it's a conspiracy or a hoax simply because it's not a direct threat to them. You know, you're going to be fine. Your six-year-old daughter's almost certainly going to be fine. But your six-year-old daughter might be the reason why some old lady gets sick, and you'll never know it, you know? And that's the reason why – I guess my frustration with a lot of this is that I come from a – like I grew up, I would argue, as kind of a Ronald Reagan Republican. We should all get along. The two political parties aren't enemies. They're just different sides of the same coin. But my slant is that less government is usually the answer, you know? But I'd contend that a big part of that growing up in this era was the understanding that if the government's going to leave me alone, it means that I need to be responsible for myself. And I think that a lot of people today want the government to leave them alone, but they forgot about the individual responsibility of a citizen.
I hate that, right?
I find it very
frustrating. That whole responsibility thing. Oh, with rights, the other part of that is responsibilities. Viktor Frankl says, you know, on the West Coast, to be kind of the bookend with the Statue of Liberty should be the Statue of Responsibility.
Oh, I love that idea. Let's build that. Let's do a Kickstarter.
It'll
look like a PFC with a mop.
Right outside the Golden Gate Bridge. Statue of Responsibility, man.
Because a lot of us don't like being told what to do by the government. I find it also troubling that a lot of people are calling on the federal government to tell their state governments what to do. Because I think that we should – this is one of those situations where your local government is supposed to be kicking ass. Local governments should be solving this problem. National governments should be supporting, providing resources. You know, the federal government should be giving money, giving equipment, giving supplies, but local governments should be all over this. And I think that a lot of the press is trying to paint that as a negative thing. You know, you see people like, oh, you know, there's no continuity across the country on how we're reopening. Why on earth would there be? There should be no continuity across the country.
No,
Georgia. But what do you say? Atlanta.
What do you say? And when you see it all over the media, you're like, oh my God. I mean, Christ's words, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. I mean, it's like, dude, like, are you writing that just to? Is it clickbait? Right.
I think it must be.
Because it 50 yeah you there should be not only 50 different responses but a different response for every county as well. So
absolutely,
I don't get it.
You know, and I would argue that's kind of what Governor Kent here in Georgia did wrong. I was looking at the data, and basically it all came down to one number, and it was that rate of infection number.
Right.
And as soon as it dropped below a certain point, it meant that they had effectively arrested community spread. And that means that at this point, we're just kind of identifying people who already had it, but we didn't know. It's not really spreading throughout. And we crossed that barrier into having arrested community spread and immediately lifted the lockdown, which I could make a good argument for. Maybe we should wait a week or two.
Right.
But what I think he really did wrong wasn't opening the state back up. It was not communicating effectively with the mayors of Georgian communities and with the people in Georgia. You know, he basically went on TV and said, we're going to open it back up. But he didn't explain, this is the data that I'm looking at. This is what it shows us. And this is why it's okay to open back up. But I still need you guys to be responsible adults. You still need the social distance. You still need to wear masks if you want to wear masks. I know they're not that effective. But the communication that went along with the open up order is where he failed. I think that the data supported his decision. I'm worried that because a lot of Georgia's population aren't effectively aware, they haven't been educated by their local government about how to do this the best way. I worry that, you know, we've seen since Georgia opened up a week ago, the chances of getting infected have increased by 40%. But one could contend that's par for the course.
Right.
We've also seen a really sharp uptick in the number of people testing positive.
Right.
But I can tell you personally, it's because there hasn't been testing in rural Georgia yet. And now there's starting to be.
Right.
So we're obviously going to see a surge. So we're in a situation now where there's going to be a surge anyway. We're now adding a new variable that could well result in an additional surge. And it's tough to know what the numbers mean until a month from now.
Right.
So,
well, and that's why, to go back to your statement about rates, to me, that's why you focus on rates, not total numbers. Because as Alex said, well, all of a sudden, you know, now we can, you know, much has been made about the technologies in state labs. And as that comes online, we can quadruple the amount of testing we can do. All of a sudden, the headline you read is, you know, Georgia cases quadruple, right? Written by some liberal, right, who has it in for this governor of Georgia. Well, the important part was the rate actually declined. And so what you saw is an increase in testing. But because of
social
distancing practices, the rate actually went down. Well, that's great news, right? That's great
news. Because what we want, ultimately, we're not going to be able to stop the spread of this virus, right? We know that. I think that if we could have, we would have over this past month. What we can do, what we need to do, is just make sure that we don't overwhelm hospital infrastructure. And that's actually one of my bigger concerns about this, is that we have placed so much emphasis, so much focus, allocated so many resources to urban city centers, which obviously need them.
Right.
But rural communities are going to get hit hard by this, I think, in the coming weeks. I think that in a lot of ways here in Georgia and in other places in the country, we're entering into what very well may be the most dangerous sort of couple of months, not because we're all so much more likely to get it or so much more likely to die, but because now is when we're trying to figure out how we can effectively live in spite of the presence of COVID-19, which isn't going to go away anytime soon, right? So just like you were saying about being sustainable, now we're trying to determine what is sustainable. We're going to have to keep our eye on the numbers. It doesn't mean failure if the numbers go up. It doesn't necessarily mean success if the numbers are arrested, because we're in a marathon here, not a sprint. We need to not just get to the end of this month, but get to the end of this year and forward in the best way that we feasibly can. So it is going to be more dangerous as we guess and check. But that's why we as citizens need to be more responsible. We can offset the increase in risk, that risk being us trying to figure out how we can most effectively get the economy machine turning again without overwhelming the hospital infrastructure. And we might stumble. We might trip. That doesn't mean failure. It doesn't mean lock the state up.
Expect it, right? It's going to be
exactly
the question. You know, it's the requirement is not right. Is not perfection. It's the relentless pursuit of winning, and you're going to have to evolve it to the win. You're not. And again, I don't think you can go to you. You're not going to be able to go in reverse. You got to evolve it more towards the Swedish approach, which is let's manage this thing. Right. Let's take care of the most vulnerable. Let's make sure. But and you know, Alex, one of the things that I mean, think about this: the governor of the state of New York went on TV and said he needed 30,000 respirators. He used 6,000, but there was assets moving from all over the country because he was on TV screaming for it. Well, I didn't see, I might have missed it, but I didn't see anybody screaming for any part of rural America.
I agree. That's what has me so nervous. You know, I do want to point out that as much as I tend to complain about how rural America is kind of being forgotten, the first time my mom needed to be tested last month, it took 2 full weeks for her to get her results. This past week when my mom needed to be tested because she had a fever, she had the cough, she was not doing well, she was very tired, she needed to be tested. They said it would be 3 to 7 business days. But then on Saturday, when her condition worsened further, they got her in for a rapids test, and she found out same day. Now, I know that it's still not great, that a month ago it took 2 weeks. Last week it feasibly could have taken a week. And then when she kind of clicked into the higher risk category, she was able to get in there for faster results. But at the same time, that is a massive improvement over a very short period of time. You know, we're talking 2 weeks to 1 week is a 100% improvement in timelines. And then from 1 week to same day, we're talking about, you know, a 700% improvement if you want to do it day by day. We're talking about a really dramatic improvement here in rural, I would argue, often forgotten America. So even though I am stressed out and I'm frustrated that there are no ICU beds in my town, you know, so we'd have to go to Atlanta. I worry about these things, but I can say that I don't necessarily think it's that we're forgotten about, and I don't even necessarily think that anybody has failed at anything. I think it's just a huge machine, and it takes time for a wheel to start rolling in D.C. and get down here to rural Georgia. And we as Americans are going to have to be kind of cognizant of that, because we want to jump down Donald Trump's throat when he says, I ordered 6 million new N95 masks, you know, and we've got them today. We don't realize that if we've got them today in a warehouse, it means 6 to 8 weeks before they get to anyone. You know, we expect responses and solutions immediately. We forget that there are 330 million people in this country, millions of square miles, tens of millions of roads that we need to ship all this stuff through. I think that I don't know what numbers Governor Cuomo was looking at. Maybe he had numbers that indicated that 30,000 ventilators was what they'd need. I see it as a victory that they didn't end up needing as much, assuming he was looking at good data. But I think that's part of the problem here, is that we as the general public are being forced to kind of take that critical eye and go, okay, which politicians do we think are lying to us? Which news outlets?
Well,
do we
I would say this, not necessarily panic. Lying, but I would say overreacting to a daily snapshot in a dynamic event. Now, we in the military get used to making decisions with not a whole lot of information, and we know the requirement then becomes being relatively nimble, right? That's not how the government and elected officials tend to make decisions. They are very deliberate. They study the shit out of it. And so I think what you've seen is you've seen people ill-prepared for public dynamic decision-making that is forced on us all the time in conflicts around the world. And so
I think that's a great point. I really do. I also think that it's easier as the governor to demand huge things from the federal government. It insulates you from criticism to a certain degree, because when you can say, when you're the governor, you know, what does it hurt you to demand 30,000 ventilators, right? And then when the president says, I don't think you guys need 30,000 ventilators, we can all say what an asshole the president is. Right. The governor's just being careful. It's easy to demand as a way to cover your own six.
Right.
It's a lot harder to fulfill.
Well,
as
and,
a way
and,
to cover
and again,
yours.
But the other point in this, and when Alex says rural Georgia, right, strike Georgia and fill in rural anywhere. Okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
Rural anywhere. Right. You know, and they're competing, you know, we're competing around the country, you know, for that. And so to me, that's what Sweden has said. Look, you know, we failed at this. You know, we're not happy with our response relative to our assisted, you know, living facilities, relative to the way we've treated our senior citizens. And we need to take a hard look at it. And so to me, as we get ready to come out of this and know that it'll wash through the healthy part of the population, protecting the unhealthy, with a particular focus on senior living centers wherever the hell they are, and whether they be in big cities or rural areas, you know, that's something that has to get higher on the target priority list.
No, I agree completely. And especially because in a lot of these communities, it's not at all uncommon for medical workers to work in more than one facility, you know?
Right.
Which in situations like this is a very, very risky endeavor. At the same time, you know, you can't ask a CNA who makes $9 an hour to quit her second job. She obviously didn't get it for fun, right? But the risk to nursing home patients is really, really high, not just because they have their high risk people. This is the highest risk demographic that we have in the country, but also because the people that they're directly exposed to on a day to day basis are people whose jobs it is to interact with sick people.
Right.
You know, so it's a dangerous situation. But I can say, as much as I worry and as much as I wish my mom would retire, she was supposed to retire a year ago. I told her I would pay her mortgage if she'd just retire. I'll get a second job.
What was and her response to that was?
If all the nurses retired, then where would we be? You know, and I really respect that,
right.
But I also hate it. So.
Right.
I would argue that if all the nurses, you know, with significant past medical histories that are like past the age of retirement and could feasibly retire, just retire. But I know that if everybody did that, we'd be in trouble. So I'm grateful to everyone who's out there taking that risk. I just wish my mom wasn't one of them.
I'm with you. Let's switch gears. The CNO and the acting Secretary of the Navy recommended that Captain Crozier be reinstated. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff recommended to the SecDef that there be a full investigation done, which will take months. Is that a vote of no confidence for the Secretary of the – well, the acting SecNav, nobody cares. I don't even know who his
name
is.
Mostly the CNO, right?
Is that a vote of no confidence for the CNO?
I'm not sure. The chief of naval operations, his name is escaping me right now, but what? I know he's a respected dude. He's got a significant history of making good decisions behind him.
Gilday.
I'm not sure.
Mike Gilday is his name.
Yeah, Gilday. Yeah, Admiral Gilday. I don't know. I wonder if part of it was Mark Esper's got to be aware of the significance of this decision in terms of establishing precedent, right? We are amid unprecedented times. I acknowledge that. I totally understand that. And there very well could be facets of our system that cannot respond fast enough. I genuinely believe there are. You know, I think I told you before, I've got a buddy who works in aviation, who the day after the government told them to close their facility down, the FAA showed up to audit them, and they had to open the facility back up. Our government does not respond quickly to things.
Right.
So there may be – this may be one of those crazy sets of circumstances where we could go, the system was so slow, the system was so bad that this was justified. I'm not convinced that that's what the case was. It very well could be. I'm happy to be wrong. I think it was – I was very surprised to see the CNO recommend reinstating Captain Crozier. For the same reasons why we talked about, jumping on the grenade is a noble act. It doesn't defuse the grenade. The action he took, he knew was going to cost him his career, and it did. You know, feasibly not forever, as you've mentioned before. He could very easily end up in another command and bounce back from this. But I honestly, man, I don't know. This is a difficult position for Esper to be in. Because with the CNO recommending that they reinstate him, Esper now needs to make sure that this decision is so heavily vetted that he is above criticism for it. So he's got to make sure that Crozier's got no skeletons in his closet. He's got to make sure that nobody in the chain of command above Crozier has any secrets to keep. Because if he is reinstated, the huge news is going to be, okay, so who are we going to blame for this?
Right.
Because a captain was relieved. A sailor died. Who are we going to blame? If not him, somebody. So there's a lot of admirals right now who are nervous about how this is going to pan out. I'd imagine there are a lot of captains who are nervous about how this will pan out. And Esper, I guarantee you, is terrified because this decision is going to play a role in the presidential election this coming year. And as a result of that, his decision may well go down in the history books. You know, so I don't know. I'm not sure that I would call this a lack of faith in Gilday. I think that it may well be Esper just being aware of how heavy a choice this is and wanting to make sure that there is nothing that could potentially bite him in the ass if he were to follow that guidance. But to be honest, I still would not be crazy surprised if he didn't reinstate him. I'm not sure I would.
I just you said something about precedent. So what would. So the next time now you're an 06 commander, you're a regimental commander, brigade commander in the Army, and you're not happy, something that you think is going to materially impact your command is going on. Hell, right? Crozier survived and he went public. Fuck it. Send.
That's my concern. You nailed it. Nail on the head.
Yeah.
Because hear me out. I understand and I agree that a lot of people feel as though Crozier's behavior has since been justified, right? The thing is, though, is that in that moment – now, I cannot pretend that I know every facet of communications at that level of chain of command within the Navy. But I can tell you that when I was a Lance Corporal, I could walk into my battalion commander's office and tell him that I was mad at my gunny. Now, if my complaints were not justified, I'd probably be held accountable for that. But I could request mast and go straight to the CO, right? I have to assume that as the captain of a supercarrier, you could very similarly go straight to your CO, right? And you could say, the system is screwed up. This is broken. We've got to do something. Right now, maybe he tried to do that informally. Maybe he even had informal off-the-record conversations with his leadership that led to him making the decision to, I would argue, intentionally go public with this. But again, we really do have to worry about the next time there's an illness that breaks out on a carrier or the next time there's a command in the field who's worried about burn pits or the next time anything that we could potentially worst case scenario this in our heads.
Epidemic of sexual harassment on my ship.
A great example. You know, we're setting a historical precedent that it is okay to step outside the chain of command when you feel it's important enough. That's dangerous.
And keep your job. Let me read you an email.
And keep your job. Yeah.
Right. Let me read you an email. Interesting discussion about these nuances relative to Gilday. I think it is a no vote of confidence for two reasons. One, the statement that it sends, as you guys are pointing out, as I hit send on this, to everybody else is that it's okay to go outside of the chain of command. Now, that technically might not be wrong, but that will be the chief lesson, and the DOD cannot have that. Two, I would say, were I the chairman to Gilday, you know, by recommending this, you keep this story in the news and you keep the shit show that has been the United States Navy prominent in the headlines.
Which it's important to note, that's a great point. It has been a bad year for the Navy. When people keep asking me, why did the Navy release these UFO videos? The first thing I point out is the Navy acknowledged these UFO videos last September. I actually broke that story. So this isn't new that the Navy or the Pentagon is saying, oh, the UFOs are out there. They said it last year. These videos were released 3 years prior to that. The reason why the Navy all of a sudden released UFO videos is because all of the news pertaining to the United States military for the news cycle, as far back as I can recall at this point, has either been about Navy war crimes, the mismanagement of Navy war crimes investigations and trials, ship collisions, the mismanagement of ship personnel and training, and now the spread of COVID-19 on naval vessels. The relief of a captain of one of our only 11 super carriers in service, the resignation of the Secretary of the Navy for his unprofessional handling of that. I mean, it goes on and on. All right. We have is bad news about the Navy.
So let's
talk about some UFOs.
They went shiny object?
Yeah. Yeah. And it worked to their credit. It did work. Lots of people.
Well, you know what? And let me just finish the email. So I would fault Gilday for his management of the service, because were we to reinstate Crozier, this thing goes high order again. His job is to make this stuff stop. Everybody's heart may break for Captain Crozier, but he was relieved. It's done. Let's move on. Give him another good job. Don't end his career. But the Navy's got to put some damage control into this son of a bitch and get out of the crosswalk and the headlights of shit shows.
I think that you make a great point. I will, however, counter that I do not like the idea of our military leaders making decisions not based on the evidence at hand or their genuine assessment, but rather based on how they worry the press is going to manage the story. I know that that's real life, though. I understand Perception matters more than truth.
It's called for the good of the service, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like, and you know, in the same way, it can go both ways. You know, right. The flag raising on Iwo Jima means the Marine Corps for the next 100 years. The relieving of the captain of the Roosevelt means the Navy's embarrassment for the next 10. I don't know. That's a tough one for me, only because
only until the next terrible event happens.
Yeah, exactly. I would have rather we didn't know what the CNO and the SecNav's recommendation was until a decision had been made. Right. I guess if I could have what I want.
No, you know, I would tell you that. Why was that announced? Why wasn't this not done? You know, via phone call, we're going to make our recommendation to you. We will not communicate or have any comment on it until you guys act on it. Because
I think that would be appropriate, you know, and justified. Yeah, would do that if it were a criminal hearing.
Yeah, I would. I would do it on the download. At the end of the day, you know, it's like something like 48,000 sailors on the ship. It's like 20 to 25% were exposed to it. Less than 10 sailors, I think, were in the ICU. It might be less than 6.
I think it was 9 is what I got, but only
in the ICU.
Yeah, 9 total.
Were hospitalized.
But I think that only like 3 total were actually in life-threatening.
Okay, and then with 1 death. I mean, so those numbers, if you look at the whole quote unquote crisis, I mean, shit, you're more likely to have those. You're as likely to have those if you go on a libo call in, you know, the Philippines.
That's feasible. I will, however, you know, play devil's advocate here. You know, it's similar to the social distancing and the shelter at home stuff, you know, out here in the population as a whole. I think that things going well after we took action is not necessarily an indicator that we shouldn't have taken action.
Right.
It's instead an indicator of the action we took being effective.
Well, right? And I think what happens is, especially with this case in particular, it's that they were on in a confined space with, you know, recirculating ventilation. So all the things that you would not be. So this is a population of 4,800 that's certainly overexposed to the COVID virus. And so when you look at the statistics relative to it, you know, and this is the healthy part of the population. I think there are some. It's its own little petri dish, which I find, you know, pretty interesting.
That's definitely interesting.
Let me ask you about some of the stuff that's on your website, China and Hollywood. Talk to me.
Yeah, so this actually, I'm really pleased with the amount of attention this story got. I've been covering China's perception management campaigns for at least 3 years now. A lot of people tend to think of Russia as the narrative villain out there in the world because of Russia's bot farms and troll farms and their social media activity. The truth is that China has a far more expansive and far more effective narrative management a plan, so overarching strategy in place. And we saw it firsthand last year with the NBA and with Blizzard. You know, for anybody who may not remember exactly, one team manager came out in support of the Hong Kong protests, and the NBA lost literally billions of dollars as a result because China's influence is disguised as big bags of money, you know? So Hollywood is, I would argue, one of the most egregious cases of that. Where here in the United States, when you release a movie, you know, Mac and I could make a movie right now if we wanted to. And then if we wanted it to get released in theaters, we would submit it to the MPAA, which is a civilian organization that, corrupt as it may be, gives us a rating. And a lot of theaters will let you run any movie that's been rated. So we can make a movie all about how much we hate the government and that it's evil and horrible. Just ask Michael Moore and you can get a theatrical release. China does not work that way. So the Chinese government censors anything that its public gets to see through the media, including the internet. The Chinese government also maintains controlling stakes in Chinese corporations, and the Chinese government decides which foreign films get released on the Chinese market. Now, that's really important because the Chinese market has rapidly become where most of the big budget movies in America actually make their profit. A lot of movies over the past 5-10 years were cost a fortune to make, grievously underperformed in the United States, then made $250 million in China, and the movie then became a success. Venom is a great example. Rampage, basically anything that Dwayne Johnson's been in for the last 5 years. These movies barely make their production cost, if not lose money, stateside, and they make a fortune overseas in China. Now, the reason why that matters is because the Chinese government has used that leverage to decide how China gets to be depicted in movies. And in this article, I break down a lot of examples that people might be surprised to know that while the American government won't tell you what has to be in your movie, the Chinese government will. And the reason why this is in the news again is because Ted Cruz just proposed legislation that would bar the Pentagon, the Defense Department, from providing support to movies that yield to Chinese government demands. And that's a big deal because most of these movies involve the military. They need military support to be able to show aircraft and military personnel and aircraft carriers. And just about every Marvel movie you can think of has bent to Chinese demands. Just about every big budget action movie of the past 5 years has bent to Chinese demands. Even the new Top Gun changed Maverick's jacket patches to reflect no Japan or Taiwanese flags because China doesn't like them. China controls how we see China in our own culture.
And how the rest of the world, there was a day, and Alex and I have talked about this in the past, that certain scenes were shot a second time for Chinese consumption.
Absolutely.
Right. No longer is that enough. China.
That's not, you right? nailed it. It's not right? cost effective. So right. now we just all get the China cut.
Yeah. Now you all get China's view of China and China's view of the world. So it's interesting.
A few really brief examples that you might be interested in if you're out there and you're like, what's he talking about? The Karate Kid, the remake in 2010, didn't have any karate in it because Jackie Chan is a member of the Chinese Communist Party. He's actually an outspoken supporter of them. He's a member of the government.
Right.
And so he demanded that the movie retcon past Karate Kids to be about kung fu rather than karate. And even when they were making the movie, they refused to call it the Karate Kid in Chinese. They named it the Kung Fu Dream. So the entire Karate Kid plot was changed just because China doesn't like Japan. In Iron Man 2, they cast Sir Ben Kingsley to play a character called the Mandarin because China wouldn't let a Chinese villain be in the movie if it was going to be released. Tilda Swinton was cast as the Ancient One, which is a Tibetan character. And the studio got accused of whitewashing again. It was because China wouldn't let a Tibetan character be featured in a movie in their market. It goes on and on. You know, Looper, a third of the movie was changed to reflect China instead of Paris. Red Dawn, the remake, the whole movie was filmed with China as the bad guy. Then the Chinese government released an op-ed in their own newspaper, and the studio hired five different companies to change all the Chinese flags, all the Chinese language to North Korean flags and language right before the movie released so that we could think that North Korea somehow invaded and occupied the United States. Our movies changed dramatically based on Chinese governmental demands. So if Ted Cruz's legislation, which has the ridiculous name of like the salute, you know, doctrine or whatever, it's a terrible acronym about the talkies. But if this legislation goes through, it'll force studios to decide, okay, do we want to covet the $200 million we'll get from China, or do we want to covet support to get these fighter planes in our movie, which in a movie like Top Gun is essential, you know? So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out.
Talk to me about next story that I saw is the U.S. Space Force and Iran's new satellite. Now, there's a couple aspects, you know, to that story. One was, you know, a lot of people surprised that Iran had the capability to put something like that on a rocket and shoot it into outer space, and there's implications for that. And then the satellite itself, what it does, and is it functioning? So talk to me about that.
So you nailed it. A lot of people are very interested in the fact that Iran was able to put a satellite in orbit because while we don't have a whole lot of faith in Iran's space capabilities, what that really demonstrates is the capacity to launch a ballistic missile a great distance, right? Now, Iran is obviously pursuing nuclear weapons. The next step after you develop your first nuclear weapon is miniaturizing it sufficiently to fit into a warhead or a bomb, right? So North Korea has the bomb, but thus far they haven't really demonstrated high survivability on the reentry vehicle. So North Korea has the bomb, but maybe not the missile. Iran is kind of demonstrating that they have the missile, maybe not quite yet the bomb. And because these two nations do work together on a lot of things, that's got far-reaching implications. But the thing that I liked the most about this story is that the commander of the Space Force took to Twitter to literally say, you know, Iran's bragging about their new satellite. It's just a tumbling webcam in space. It was something called a CubeSat, which is about 11 centimeters squared or cubed, excuse me. It's a really tiny little thing that's just tumbling out there in space. It effectively could provide no actionable intelligence whatsoever. But it's important to note that Iran's real goal wasn't to jump into the realm of space orbital operations, wasn't to compete with the U.S.'s spy satellites. Their real goal was to show how far they could launch a missile, and it looks like pretty far.
No, I mean, if it was message sending that you were looking to do, then I think everybody got the memo. Hey, what was that? What was that? Here's another email. Relative to Alex's point about Senator Cruz, I think these guys like Cruz and Cotton, while they have been right for a long time, there has been no real impetus to see China for what it is. I think that will change. It will be interesting to see what happens with legislation about paying a percentage or all of the costs for a factory to come back to the United States or other manufacturing means to come back to the United States. Now, after the latest stories of China knew that the virus was present, did not announce so it could buy up assets they needed to fight the pandemic inside of China. We'll see as more of the story comes, but I believe the demand and the rational basis for doing all of that will be out there. It'll be interesting to see how far it goes.
I agree. And my only fear is effectively that here in the States, we have a really bad habit of politicizing things. Nope, you know, so if you believe in climate change, you have to be a Democrat. If you know what I mean? Like this right. just tends to be how we go. And I hope that we manage to avoid that with this. I really do not want to see holding China accountable become a mainstay of only the Republican Party. You know, because conservatives are the ones that are kind of leading the way into this, I fear that there's going to be that liberal backlash of just anything that comes out of this guy's mouth is bad.
Well,
right?
Joe Biden was even China bashing. And I'll tell you what, he and President Obama, they did nothing but China love when they were in office. So it was interesting to
I
see
agree.
That.
You know,
that
a lot
was
of
like,
the
whoa.
We're in tough shape in the South China Sea because of the Obama years. Not solely because of the Obama years, but they certainly didn't help. Right? But right. I guess that's I want to see both Republicans and Democrats jump on this bandwagon where we're going to hold China accountable for stealing intellectual property, where we're going to hold China accountable for its behavior following the COVID-19, where we're going to hold China accountable for the way that they use economic leverage to force other nations down onto one knee. And if we think it's bad in America, where they have a great deal of control over movies, where they have a great deal of control over American sports, over American video games, if you think it's bad in America, where we have the most powerful economy on earth, just think about how bad it is in the spheres of influence China has established in Africa and in other third world or developing countries where they're using the Belt and Road Initiative to loan billions of dollars to these developing nations that likely won't have the credit to repay them. China knows that, and they're going to use it for leverage to do whatever they want in the future to continue to grow their presence globally. If China has the ability to take the most powerful nation on earth and effectively freak the entire NBA out, which are some of the most wealthy business owners in the nation, if China can do that here, China can do a great deal more in nations that have nowhere near the economic viability that we have. China's a bad guy, and we need to look it right in the face and come after it as a team. And the worst thing that we could really do is do what we did with Russia, do what we did with the climate and a lot of these other things where we made it a one-party issue. So I hope Joe Biden continues China hating. He certainly didn't the last time he worked in the executive branch.
All right. Tell everybody where they can find your work and what's going to be new on Sandbox this week.
You got it. Well, please, please, please swing by sandboxnews.com. That's Sandbox with two X's, news.com. We've got a ton of great content coming out, ranging from stories from military spouses about what it's like to PCS amid all of this craziness, right down to Delta Force operators telling you what one piece of gear they would recommend that you have if you had to go live in the woods for a while. And spoilers, it's nothing cool and sexy. It's like a shovel with a knife on it. But the only coronavirus-related content you're going to get from us is either genuine experiential content, people living in the military right now and talking about what they're doing, or official announcements coming from the DOD that we're just trying to keep you in the loop on. Other than that, we're trying to bring our focus back to living life despite all of the craziness related to the coronavirus. You know, we've all got to get back to work, not just at our jobs, but also get back to work on bettering ourselves, get back to work on taking care of our families. We've gotten to spend, for some of us, it's been worse than others, but we've gotten to spend a lot of time kind of just licking our wounds and going, man, this sucks. but it's not going to end soon. So now we've got to focus on how we're going to live despite it. And that's my focus moving forward on Sandbox News. So come swing by Sandbox News for some positivity, for some good news, and to stay informed. And you can also obviously find me on social media, on Twitter at AlexHollings52 and on Facebook at AlexHollingsWriter.
There he is, Alex Hollings. All right, man. First of all, congratulations on the news about your mom. And
thank you very, very much. I'll tell her you said so. She loves you and your show. She's probably listening.
Well, now I love her more. All the best of luck to you. And no, the issue you bring up about rural Georgia is a huge issue across the country. And to me, that's the reason to study what Sweden's doing is Sweden, you know, is doubling down on what we need to do for the most vulnerable. And so I think that's why that's a kind of an interesting thing to follow.
And to that point out there in listener land, if you belong to a political affiliation or you identify with a political party that says something's a bad idea, like maybe you're part of a group that thinks Sweden did wrong and we did right or whatever it may be, I'd ask, pay attention to what's going on, not just along party lines, not just for your team. A good idea is a good idea wherever it comes from. Our goal is to get through this. It's not to win. It's not for one party or the other to assert dominance. The goal is for us to get through this. If it's a good idea, it doesn't matter where it comes from. It's a good idea.
Right. Which is, you know, I'll tell you what, talk about a little bit of uplifting sentiment over the weekend when, you know, you saw Warren Buffett essentially or quoted this. And what he said was, bet on American, you know, magic. That you know, the United States, you know, for the last almost 100 years has been a magical country on the planet, and you could make the case it's been a magical, you know, a miracle for a lot longer than that. But anyway, but you know, you're going to see the United States do what it does best, which is overcome and come together and do those things. So it's interesting, and I think encouraging for a lot of people to see him actually say that in print, that said, hey, you know, bet on great companies. We'll bet on a great nation to overcome, you know, adversity. And it was kind of cool to see him say that over the weekend. So,
yeah, that's awesome.
Along the lines. All right, man, give your mom my best.
You got it. Thanks, brother.
All right, there you have it. Alex Hollings here on a Monday edition of Balmarine Radio. And again, Sandbox, right? If you go to the website, the Sandbox website, you'll see across the top, right? So you get there, sandbox.org, right? sandbox.us. And then you'll see the news tab across the top, right? And you just click on that and you'll find all the work that Alex and his crew do. So there's a whole bunch of it. There's a story about the Citadel on there today. There's a story about the Space Force and a story about Military Spouse Appreciation Day, which is he just alluded to. So anyway, you'll find his all his work there. That'll do it. Hour one, we talk about I'm done with all my projects, man. Every project that I have conceived, I've now executed. So I am project free. I'm project free. Yeah. So I outlined my fight with fluorescent lighting yesterday. And I'll defend relying on my intuitive fix-it skills as opposed to actually looking at a wire diagram. And normally I'll even go, right, and watch YouTube. I did not on this event. Not sure why. So, anyhow, you'll hear that. But probably most important, I think that you probably read a lot about Sweden and their approach to the COVID-19 thing. But I don't. There was an interview done with USA Today last week, and the link is in the hour one post. So there's two links. One is a Tom Friedman article, headline is Sweden getting it right with its COVID-19 approach? But Friedman actually has part of it wrong, right? And so if you read the whole interview that's in USA Today, if you read that whole interview, I think you'll find it very interesting. So those are both posted. And I think what's important as the nation tries to come out of this is Swede's approach talks about you're going to have to live with this for the long term. And what a lot of nations did that use the American approach is that they hit the pause button. And when you hit the play button, it's coming back. And the numbers are going to go up. And so what do you focus on? You focus on the rates, not the numbers. So know that. And at some point, it will wash through the healthy members of our culture and of our population. And so it's incumbent upon the nation and the states and the counties and the cities to protect people that are vulnerable. And in this country, what it points to is we have a crisis in our nursing homes. We also have a crisis of obesity, and that's one of the factors. So we talk about that in hour one too. So on a Monday, Will Cosentini going to join me tomorrow? Yeah, we're going to talk about citizens giving up rights really quickly. He's uncomfortable with that. Will got out as a colonel. We served together a couple times in Iraq in 2004. He was battalion commander. And when I was working for General Mattis. And then we were instructors at the basic school together in 1990-91. So Will's a good dude. So you're going to hear more from him tomorrow. On a Monday, Allmarine Radio. Over and out. And don't be afraid to change somebody's life, man. Don't be afraid. I had a series of conversations about post-traumatic winning over the weekend. You're going to start seeing little five-minute snippets on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram about coping, right? About coping. So, anyway, have a great one. On a Monday, out.